Mr. Eggers, just before you go on to this next topic, Dr. Giles has a question that she wants to ask you.
Sure.
You did refer to information having been updated, and you listed the marine mammals and seabirds and updated sound through modelling. Have any technical reports been prepared for these updates that are all? And if so, where would we find those in the
information document? I'll defer to Alison on that, but yes.
Yes, there are several. We can dig those out for you. And when they are listed in the at various points in this document, and we can point to them.
That would be really helpful. Yeah. I'm sure they're there. It's just all still relatively new, and it would come. It would be helpful to get to a point too. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. And Chair, if you think I'm going too slow or too fast, you just give me a bell.
You're doing perfectly fine, so
thank you.
Just carry on.
Okay, we'll move on now to the environmental advantages. You might call it environmental effects. What are we doing out there? We have a very small environmental footprint at any one time. Yes, we're out there for 20 years, but at any one time, there's only 0.27 of a square kilometre that's being disturbed. It's either not being touched or it's being rehabilitated. And we have a very low carbon footprint. If we're worried about carbon emissions, and that's not what you're here to judge, but these deposits and how and the technology that we're applying to extract and beneficiate the minerals here, it's very low carbon. And a simple reason for that is nature's done it. Very good job of high grading the mineral sands, if you like, and concentrating them into virtually a saleable commodity sitting on the seabed ready to get rid of. We do not have overburden forests and streams and water management issues to deal with, such as you do on land-based operations. There's no heavy mining fleet and haulage fleets, which you'll see around most large mines, including here in New Zealand, if you look at Waihee or Macraes. There are no open pits or overburden stripping, as I said. There are no waste or tailings dumps. We're not. We're just putting back the deoured sand. When the black sand comes up and goes back down, I defy you to see the difference. We've extracted 10% of it, which is the high-grade titanomagnetite. Black sand up, black sand coming down. I'll tell you a bit more in a moment about the exciting trip that some of the critters get during that. But that's just black sand, and it's black sand going back. There are no haul roads. There's no energy-intensive crushing and grinding circuits in all major mines, including iron ore mines around the world, have huge carbon footprints in grinding and crushing that mineral to get it into an export saleable commodity. This is done for us. We do have light grinding on board, but it's basically to disaggregate clumps of sediment that come up, clumps of iron sands that come up, and burst them apart so that they go through the circuit and we can extract the best of it. But we're not actually grinding. And somebody said the other day, they're grinding, they'll be putting more fines into the ocean and causing problems. We collect the fines, that's what we're after. It's a coarse material that goes back down, not the fines. So it's the exact opposite. So we have a low carbon footprint, and in terms of harvesting, in 1 year we'll harvest about 3 square kilometres out there. Here in New Zealand, you're busy, harvesting about 1,800 square kilometres of cropping fields each year. That seems to be okay. And all we're doing, as well as upsetting a few worms perhaps as well, which turn up, come back. We're just on the 5 metre average on the top, 1 to 11 metres deep, simple magnetic separation, no chemical additives or processing, no permanent seabed installations or fixtures of any sort. When we leave, if we go bust, we leave, there'll be nothing left out there for you to see or go and complain about. Natural processes delivered rapid rehabilitation of the mined areas. They recolonised within weeks and full recovery within 2 years. And that's progressive as we go along. There is no impact on fish, whales or dolphins. And again, Alison will explain this in much more detail, and I'm going to give you a little bit of it in a moment. There are no legacy issues with continuous rehabilitation as part of the recovery process. We're not going to leave a mess out there. In 2017, we got our consents approved, our marine and our marine discharge consents approved by the EPA. Those consents came with a set of 109 comprehensive conditions to operate and a detailed set of management and operating plans, which we'll go through in a moment as well. And a 30-year plus marine effects monitoring program. Well, TDR is actually going to deliver you a bonus on that. Because it's taken so long to get through this approval process, we commenced marine research out there in 2011. We're now at 2025, and we've still got our 30-odd years to go. So you're going to get 40 or 50 years of marine research in the South Taranaki Bight that you didn't have before. And we're proud to deliver that. Okay, the proposed conditions provide the following set of management and monitoring plans. I am not going to go through and explain each one. I am going to mention each one. There's a pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan, as I've explained a bit about the reasons for that. There's an environmental monitoring and management plan. That is to set up the sites in the South Taranaki Bight and monitor them. There's a seabird effects mitigation and management plan. There's a marine mammal management plan. There's a collision, loss of position, contingency management plan for our vessels. There's simultaneous operations plan with our colleagues out there in the oil and gas and the fishing industry. There's a biosecurity management plan for our vessels and coming and going. There's a Kai Moana monitoring program, which we would like to see a lot of this work done by the South Taranaki iwi groups themselves. I'll show you shortly. We will provide the vessels and wherewithal and pay for it. But we would like them to undertake this. It doesn't matter what the past has been. We know we have to work with those groups. We will be working with those groups. We want to train them, get them jobs, and we would like them to undertake the Kai Moana monitoring plan, but in fact the whole environmental monitoring plan. We will need some fairly highly skilled people and scientists on that program, but we would like them to come from the local community. And we have a post-extraction monitoring plan, as I said. So we've delivered a very comprehensive environmental application. We didn't go out there and say, just do the minimum, please, NIWA and our experts from in New Zealand, scientists and offshore. We said, go out there, look at that environment and tell us what's going on out there. You tell us. We don't know. We're a mining company. And we didn't skint. We didn't say, let's take some shortcuts here and just do enough to get across the line. Man, we fired some time and dollars at that. And these are the major headings of the reports that you'll have in front of you that we addressed. There's a lot up there, and there's more if you want to dig into the reports, and I hope you do. What's out there? I want you to watch this. We had NIWA film seabed, and I might say we've drilled thousands of drill holes from Manukau Harbour to Kapiti. We've drilled 789 in this little area. We've drilled thousands in the South Taranaki Bight around this area, including in the rest of our resource that's not up for approval at this point. Each of those drill holes has a camera. I didn't mention before, we have a camera on that when it goes down onto the seabed. We know what's there. We're not guessing. And the marine surveys we've done, we know where the reefs are. We know where it's rocky. We know where there's abundant marine life and where there's not. And where we are, this is what it looks like. It is black sand. It's got some microalgae, less than a millimetre in size, microphytobenthos, less than a millimetre in size. It's got the odd worm. As my drilling team says, the odd sea lice, in fact, quite a few sea lice in places. That's what's going to go up through the machine. Some of these blokes out here, this microalgae, and Alison will probably take offence at this, but these microalgae don't do much. They're sitting out there. The most exciting thing that's ever going to happen to them is going through our machine and out the back end, because when they get back down on the ocean floor, those less than millimetre bugs will still be alive, they'll still recolonise, and that's what's going on out here. We can do this for hours, as many hours as you like, and when you go out there on a visit, we will have these cameras. You can look at anywhere within our application area that you wish. Lower the cameras, have a look. Including if any of our opponents say, but here we have this here and we're really concerned about it. Fine, put the camera down at the location they give you and have a look. If it's in our mining area, this is what it looks like. We know because we have filmed the entire area. You want another hour of that, or shall we move on?
Well, no, if it all looks like that, I think we've probably got the picture.
You got an idea.
Thank you. Are you saying that there are no structures of any kind?
Correct. We can't mine rock. And rock is of no value to us if it came up. And as for marine life, I don't want to be flippant, but we're not producing cat food. There's no value in it for us. In fact, it interferes with processing the heavy mineral sands through the operation, and we would be burning a lot of diesel and people's time and energy out there producing nothing. Not good business. Not good for our shareholders, not good for the bottom line. Now, what is happening out there? This is an example just a week or two, three or four weeks ago, I think the date's on here, July the 4th of this year, US July the 4th day, and it's the Stony River or Hangatahua River that feeds into the South Taranaki Bight. And this is happening on a regular basis. We're not adding one grain of sediment to the South Taranaki Bight, not one grain. This is what's coming down and going into that South Taranaki Bight. Massive sediment loads off all those rivers. And the Whanganui River, if you go there, is never clear. It doesn't exactly look like the ones that are coming across the Canterbury Plains. It's never clear because of land use activity and erosion. It's full of silts and it's bringing the silts out into plumes in the South Taranaki Bight. If you walk along the beaches there, and I have many, many times spent many hours doing it, those waves are generally brown and dirty. There's a reason for that. There's a lot of sediment in there, and I'll show you more about it. That's what's happening in the South Taranaki Bight. Now, like I said, what about the plume? Well, first of all, on the seafloor, I said we've got these microphyto algae, benthos and algae, less than a millimetre in size. We've got a few worms up to a few centimetres in size, possibly the odd starfish, and Alison will be able to explain a lot more about this if you wish. The sediment, our heavy mineral sands, we're not producing a plume 24/7 even when we're operating, only if we hit silts. When we hit silts, if we've got over 1.8% silts, we stop. Because then the waters are too cloudy in our processing equipment for us to be efficient extractors of the titanium magnetite. So we stop. It's a hard limit that we've set. And as we go along, these little blokes, like I said, we'll have a fairly exciting ride. I'm through the process, but I'll go back down. But what about this plume? The plume is what our opponent sees upon. It gets the headlines in the newspaper. It's going to kill all the fish stocks in the South Taranaki Bight, and on we go. Let's just have a look at what the science. And we had this done, we sent bulk samples to the UK. We had this done by NIWA here in Wellington Earth Sciences. We sent these to H.R. Wallingford in the UK. H.R. Wallingford are experts in this area. They manage all the plume activities associated with the City of London getting all its gravels out of the English Channel. And they've got Belgium and France on their backs, like you wouldn't believe, if they create a plume that upsets them and their fishing stocks. H.R. Wallingford, we brought in here, and they're experts, and as on this microphyto benthos and things, we got Larry Cahoon from University of South Carolina, who's an expert in that, at looking at those critters as well. This plume is quite intense within about 2 kilometres of where we're operating at any one time. Yes? No denying, but it doesn't go very far when there is one, because there's heavy mineral sands and they settle very quickly. They agglomerate and they settle very quickly, and when we get high silt loadings, we stop.
What does it mean when you stop, if you get high silt loads? What physically happens to the operation?
We switch down the operation and we'll move the crawler to where we've got away from those silts. And how do we know that? Because there'll be grade control drilling in front of the operation at all times, and that's quite close drilling, within 20 to 50 metres, depending on where we are, and we know exactly where those silt layers are. We say, no, here we know we're going into that. We'll move around it, we go past it, we can come back.
Does that mean you're moving, the crawler's moving at a pace that enables you to stop it before you reach any...
It's not the quartet. This crawler is moving about like this.
Yeah.
And it's all controlled, there's nobody on the sea floor, there's nobody down there. It's all in a remote controlled upstairs on joysticks and screens.
Right.
Yeah.
And would you then deposit the material further back into the hole that was created?
Correct.
So you're able to adjust?
No, we put it back into where we've just come from. So we're moving along and we're putting the material back.
But if you stop and move the vessel and don't dig for a while.
Yeah.
How would that hole that is?
It could be, we could leave a few undulations, that's true, but with the shifting of this sea floor out here, you wouldn't see them. And a 5 metre excavation slot over 300 metres across 2 or 3 kilometres, any engineer can draw that cross section.
I mean, it could be 10 or 11, you said, right?
Yeah, but it's unlikely we would be going anywhere from there, because we know from grade control drilling that's a really valuable site, and we'd be backfilling that.
So the deposits would then be deposited on the fine seabed that you avoided?
Yeah.
And just to clarify, the plume only applies if you inadvertently bring up these silts?
Yes. There is a plume. Even with the heavy mineral sands and there's no silts, it will be a plume, but that settles very quickly because that's what they are. And it's the coarse fraction that's going back, the fine we keep. So it settles very quickly.
What does very quickly mean?
In real time.
Mm.
Can I also explain that when you go to the beach with your grandchildren, used to be with your kids, but for me it's grandchildren. When you go to the beach, you dig a sandpit, and you have a good time with your bucket and spade. These are supersaturated sands, no different. So what happens is, when they go back down, they settle and reconsolidate very quickly. So that when you've been at the beach, the next day you don't go, when the next wave comes over and fixes up your sandcastle, the kids cry, and you go home and have hot dogs. The thing is that it reconsolidates very quickly. The next day when you walk along the beach, you don't start breaking your ankles because you're stepping in where the kids built their sandcastles yesterday. It reconsolidates and you can't see where it's been. That's what's happening here. It goes back to as is. And this plume, once we get a few hundred metres away from the actual redeposition, it's not the sucking up of the sands, it's the redeposition that causes the plume, we have 1.5 milligals per litre of sediment, perhaps, in the water column. Once we're 10 or 15 kilometres away, it is down to 0.5 milligal per litre of sediment in the water column, and 0.35 on this model out to 20 kilometres away. Now, by comparison, hopefully when you give us our consents, the TDR team will have a drink. And according to the laws of the land here, we're allowed up to 500 milligals per litre of alcohol in our blood and considered safe to drive on the roads. Hopefully that's starting to put it in perspective of what this really is. New Zealand drinking water standards. The water in front of you on that table allows up to 5 milligals per litre of suspended solids and sediments. There is no plume, and I'll show you what's happening in the bite in a moment. There is no issue with this plume. You say, Alan, that's a big statement. I'll stand by it.
Can excuse me, I've got one more follow-up question. You said the fine sediments will be retained and not deposited?
Yes.
Is that the material
you're extracting? Fine black sand, that's what we're exporting.
So that's what you're exporting?
Yeah.
So no, so if there's any other fine sediments that are not the material
there will be
exporting?
Some, there will be some fines, we don't get 100%.
So you're not extracting fines per se, but
no,
the greatest proportion of the fines is what you're actually interested in?
Yes.
Thank you.
So that's what's going on out there. And here's what's happening in terms of that plume. These here are log scales on the site for the scientists amongst you. And this is a normal day in the South Taranaki Bight, just a median day. And you'll see that the concentrations of sediment in the ocean range from nothing, 0.1, up to getting up to hundreds, perhaps up in the Purple Sea, thousands of milligals per sediment, milligals of sediment, suspended sediment concentrations. Righto, here's our mining area. When we're operating, this is the difference. Now, yes, this looks like, ooh, this is a bit bigger than this up here. I'm not disputing, it is, but look at the value. That's in the just over 1 milligal per litre of suspended sediment. Nothing. You won't be able to measure that. It will be impossible for our senses to tell the difference between mining and non-mining. But during the 2016-17 hearings in Wellington, the chairman wisely said, but TDR, we can accept that. And by the way, this sediment modelling is much more complex than that and covers off on a whole lot of percentiles and ranges. And it's all in the data you've got in front of you. But what Alex Shaw, the chairman there, said, if everything turns to custard out there, what's really the worst outcome that could happen? Right. Here's when it turns to custard out there. This is where we've got a major storm event. This is where the turbidity is like you wouldn't believe. The whole place has gone wild. And we're sucking sediment, say, one of our high sediment loading areas. We've gone over 1.8%. Just note down here, we will not be operating in these conditions. We've already agreed in our conditions or proposed conditions to this panel. We will not be operating. But in out here, here it is up the top. This here is with no mining. This is with mining. It's a very highly energetic, turbid ocean, full of sediment, caused by natural causes. I've shown you how most of it gets there. This is the facts. Alison and her team and HR Wallingford's and I think McDonald, sorry, Alison, isn't it? McDonald?
McDonald and Hadfield?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They did the modelling, and Alison, I'll tell you more about that, and it's more complex than what I've shown you here, but not much different. Of course, this is also for when we're right next to the boundary. Remember, most of the time we're going to be another 14 or 15 kilometres away from that, and it's even less. And deeper water. Ah, but what about the whales? We've had a lot of problems with whales. And we've spent many thousands of hours ourselves with aerial surveys and monitoring and hydrophones trying to see whether there's any whales. And our opponents have hydrophones out here right now, including on the Coupe platform right here, listening for whales. Here's the blue whale sightings over about the last 15 to 20 years. This is not on a single day you go out here, you won't see these whales, this many. You'll be lucky if you see one. You will see perhaps a few out here on the continental shelf where upwelling currents bring the quill up and they thrive out here. A few of them travel through here occasionally from the Kaikoura coast, which you know is a very active coast down here, and you can go whale watching within a few metres off the coast because that's where they live. And these whales are migratory right around New Zealand. This is not a nursery or a breeding ground for whales, blue whales, where we are at all. No whales have been sighted ever within our proposed area of operations. The nearest one, 15 kilometres to the southwest on one day. out of about 15 years. Our opponents have hydrophones out there now, as I say, listening for whales, because there will be headline news the moment they get one in our mining area. I can assure you, it will be in the Taranaki Times so you wouldn't believe before it gets to the scientists.
Can I just ask you that that previous slide doesn't appear in the version of the presentation that we received?
I apologise, but I think you might be looking at a PDF and not the PowerPoint.
I probably am. Yeah.
And the PDF often just goes to the last. This is the next iteration of that. I apologise.
No, that's right.
Yep. So this is, yes, we have updated things. This is the mammal, the DOC Marine Mammal Base Database 2023. Remember, we're putting this together in 2024 as well, way after we've got out of the 2016 process. And here is the blue whales. And as I said, there's been one sighted within a 10-kilometre buffer of the project area. Minke whales, none or one within 5 km. Common dolphins, about 4. Hector Maui dolphins, none. There's one within 10 kilometres. Orcas, one within 5. So that's a total. None within our proposed area of operations. This is their modelling and predictability of whether or not we're likely to see a whale. And you can see the oil and gas industry and us and our tenements in here. And the black and dark purples here are really the main probability of the presence of a blue whale. We're down in this zone. You can see where they think they might traverse around and where they come along the west coast of South Island and migrate around New Zealand. That's fine. You might see a whale out there. It's not a big whale watching industry out of South Taranaki Bight because it's too far out and there are no whales there to have a look at. Dolphins, very sensitive issue, and we are all for saving the Maui dolphin. We would contribute towards that process, no problem at all. I don't see why we wouldn't. Here's our bathymetry. Here's where we are down here. I've told you about the little bulge and why I see it. This is the South Taranaki Bight. This is the dolphin, Maui dolphin register, as we understand it. And the Department of Conservation data. And they think, and it's an algorithm really, but they think there's 54 remaining. It's unsure whether there are actually any Maui dolphins at all, but there may well be. We certainly would like to save them if they do exist. There's quite a few Hector dolphins, that's a different story. All of these sightings, there have been two carcasses found in the South Taranaki Bight. There might be one or two further south here towards Kapiti, I'm not sure, but on this graphic anyway, there's two carcasses over the year washed up in the South Taranaki Bight. All the red are live sightings. They're all north of New Plymouth, up here to Manukau Harbour, and through onto, in fact, the east coast. There are no Maui dolphins where we are, albeit the Maui Dolphin Reserve, which prohibits mineral exploration and mining, has now been extended from up here to Wellington Harbour, out to this 12 nautical mile limit. It has sterilised a huge area of potential iron sand deposits. That's for another day. Forest and bird are very concerned, rightly so, that we're going to kill a few birds. If you want to kill birds, put a wind farm out there. And they're worried about noise. Our noise might affect marine mammals and even fish. Fair enough, we've got one stationary vessel sitting out here, or virtually stationary vessel. We'll have one or two Capesize vessels coming each month to export the material, and we've got one transfer vessel, loading and transfer vessel operating. We have a couple of other vessels out there, anchor handling tug, an environmental monitoring vessel to do the environmental monitoring, and a geological survey vessel to do the grade control drilling. Not a lot. This here is actual fact of vessel movements out there for a year. These vessels, some of them make less noise than us. A lot of them make a hell of a lot more noise than us. And you can see where we are. We'll be pretty quiet. We'll be minding our own business, and we're not going to affect anything very much with noise or bird strike. Forest of bird, worried about us killing a seagull, is going to fly into our vessel at night with our lights. We've got to have spotters on the vessel at all times. It's in our application consent conditions to look for this and mitigate it as best we can. But the biggest killer of birds around the world are your lounge windows and front doors. That's what kills birds. They fly into them flat out, and a lot of them die that way. We don't think it's material that our effects on seabirds will be material, and certainly not on a population level. Trawling, fishing and trawling is active in the area. This is trawling traverses for a year. You can see it's quite a busy little area. That's for the fishing industry to explain, but it's ongoing. And as I say, we've got a management agreement with Sandbirds. They're happy with us. We're as happy as they can be, I guess. And we're certainly back talking constructively, I believe, with Tallies and Seafood New Zealand.
Will the fishing boats need to stay out of your operational area or only away from the boats?
No. They'll be able to go through our operational area. They just need to give us a few hundred metres berth from our boat, but there's no problem with that.
Right.
Yeah. And they probably, where we're actually extracting, they don't want to be there because it will be disturbed. The fish will quote. I mean, they'll move away from that site. Sorry about to use that language, but they'll move away. Okay, Alison's here, but never mind. What do the experts say about the... Well, no, I do mind. Sorry, Alison, but here's what. We've got a 3.2 billion tonne deposit. It's a world-class resource and it'll be recovered while avoiding material harm and can deliver major economic and social benefits. Extensive peer-reviewed expert reports and evidence, over 12,000 pages of it that you have, has been provided to the committee that supports this and shows the South Taranaki Bight marine environment and outcomes are well understood. Alison's a quote from her evidence in 2023. The proposed mining area and adjacent area in the South Taranaki Bight are one of the best studied shallow exposed shelf marine environments in Aotearoa, New Zealand, with a wealth of studies generated by the applicant, TDR, that add to a body of existing information. The information is the best available and sufficient for me to give my expert opinion that the effects of the proposed mining operations and resulting sedimentation on biota in the South Taranaki Bight. And, in light of the Supreme Court's findings, I have considered whether granting consent, subject to the proposed conditions, will avoid material harm, will favour caution and environmental protection in relation to the effects of the proposed mining operations and resulting sedimentation on biota in the South Taranaki Bight, including ecological effects on marine mammals. In my opinion, it will. That's what the experts are saying. Might not be what the newspapers are saying. That's what the experts are saying. To summarise, it's here. It's a well-studied area. We've gone and got the information. The experts have done their job and they've delivered it. And we think that it will avoid... Well, no. I'll change that. We know it will avoid material harm. I'll stake my reputation on it, and I've got a long reputation for doing the right thing in this industry. And by the environment. I can bore you with a lot more about that, but I won't right here. But the thing is that my reputation's at stake here, and I'm proud of what we're doing. Dr. Phil Mitchell sends his apologies today as an expert planner and has worked hard on our conditions. And in May 2023, what did Phil say? I acknowledge the very clear and consistent opposition by Tangata Whenua. And all I can say that based on the technical evidence and the environmental resources of the South Taranaki Bight, from a Western science perspective, will not be materially harmed. I consider the granting of both marine and discharge consents is consistent with the overall purpose of Section 10 of the EEZ Act, in that it will promote the sustainable management of natural resources of this marine environment and protect the environment from pollution by regulating the discharge component of the activity. That's what the experts are saying. DOC opposed our first application in 2013. We were declined by the first EPA in 2014. We took notice, pulled up our socks and went back and had a look at the deficiencies. DOC, when we put in our second application that got accepted, got approved in 2016, DOC accepted all TTR's conditions to monitoring and management plans and did not consider further conservation gains would be made by submitting. They supported our second application. I spoke to DOC as recently as today, last week. They reiterated that to me face to face. So, we've done a lot of consultation and it's been ongoing. We have not stopped consulting with communities, with existing interests. This year, the Ministry for the Environment, Department of Conservation, the New Plymouth District Council, the Taranaki Regional Council, the Stratford District Council, the South Taranaki District Council, the Whanganui District Council, and the Pātia Community Board. I have presented, given them information, been there, and talked to them. The MPs for the area, we're talking to them, explaining the project. Fisheries, offshore wind, oil and gas, the Taranaki Chamber of Commerce, the Ports Authorities at Whanganui and Taranaki, Venture Taranaki and Woods Training on our training requirements and what we need to do on those fronts. We've made many attempts to engage with iwi, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment, and Paul will also be addressing that shortly. And we've got a provision for ongoing community and iwi involvement, and they're addressed in our consent conditions, and we'll direct you to those as we go through this process. This here is a kind of snapshot. There's too much in it, and I don't expect you to actually read it, but pre-2013 we had extensive engagement. We had Dame Jenny Shipley on the board, and she took us all to the marae, and we did have meetings on the marae with Ngāhi Ruanui, and we did extensive engagement. We thought we're doing the right thing, and this is ongoing. It's extensive, and I would direct you to Taka Waldron's engagement report, no application. We engaged Tahu Potiki, and I'll tell you why in a moment, to do a cultural values assessment because we were unable to get a cultural impact statement from the mana whenua in the area. And Buddy McCary's evidence to both the fast track, to the DMC and our 2016-17 application. We made, and it just goes on. What happened is once we got our consents granted and then they were challenged in the courts, most parties refused to engage with us, point blank. They said, we don't think you'll get through this, and come back when you think you got your consents and we'll talk to you. In the meantime, it's wasted energy. Despite the fact we kept on providing the information, our door's been open, it's never been closed, and it's open today. And I will say, in the last few days, we have had a positive response from two of the key iwi groups, and we're very pleased to see that.
Which two?
Rauru and Ngāhi Ruanui.
Okay.
They made a statement about the panel being announced, and we responded to that. And they have suggested that we should meet, and we're happy to do so and try to arrange it. So this goes on. What we did do is we asked Ngāhi Ruanui to do a cultural impacts statement, which is required. We paid for that to be done, and we got to the 2013 hearing and it wasn't done. We then, in the 2016 application, we requested it again, they agreed to do it, and we paid additional fees for it to be done, and we made many overtures to ensure that that was delivered on time for our application in 2017 to be heard. It wasn't delivered, so by the beginning of 2017, we asked Tahu Potiki to write a cultural values assessment, the best we could do, because we could not get the cultural impact statement we required, and we were being held to ransom to some extent by that. So that's what we did. But you can see this ongoing engagement. And for our opponents to say, they've ignored us and we haven't engaged. They took us to the High Court. They had a team of experts and lawyers in the DNC hearing before that. They took us to the courts. They had a team of lawyers and experts preparing their submissions for the courts and worked through that from 2017 to September 2021, when those court processes were ongoing. We were engaged, like you wouldn't believe, but they were there stating their position very strongly, which we respect. But we were engaged. They know that much about the project's unbelievable, because they're in great detail and their submissions are there to the courts and to the hearings. And then again, when we went to the hardware hearings. So as I say, I don't expect you to read this, but this is just ongoing with our engagement process. So in 2013, we employed a full-time iwi community relations officer in Toho Waldron. It's a fantastic guy. And we're actively engaging with groups and providing with information. We had a formal stakeholder engagement presentations to a wide range of groups in the area, from recreational fishing to local authorities to all iwi groups that would let us through the door. And I think in October 2015, digitally and hard copy stakeholder engagement packages were delivered to anybody that wanted them, and we did extensive roadshows. Okay, I'm now going to give you some, why is this project, we're now into the economic benefits. Mr. Chair, it's at 12:30, you want a break? I think we'll get there.
Okay. Thank you. We can break at whatever time's convenient for you.
Thank you. Okay. Iron ore's worth a lot of money. As I say, the major mining companies in the world, all the biggies, make it out of iron ore. And it's pretty stable. And here's from 21 to now. I think this morning it's $101. By the way, all the dollars I talk about here are US dollars. Just so you get it in context. And it's around about $101 this morning, I looked. It did get down in 2016-18. It got down to around about $70 or $80. But it's not too bad. This project made billions and billions when it got up to $226.70 a tonne back in July the 19th, 2021. It was a black gold mine. Unbelievable. But
What caused that spike?
China and the rapid growth in construction and building in China. So, but the iron ore prices are pretty good and round about $100. So we use $100. Our PFS actually uses $90. We discounted it forward, and then there's a discount on that for the material we produce. So we're going to get 5 million tonnes a year and ship it out in these large vessels, and that's 57% iron, 11 pounds of vanadium and 8.5% TiO2, titanium dioxide. That produces 18,000 tonnes of vanadium peroxide, which translates to 10,000 tonnes of vanadium metal. The rest is oxygen. So one's an oxide and the rest is metal. So about 10,000 tonnes of metal. And we have 325,000 tonnes of titanium dioxide in the concentrate as it leaves the shores of New Zealand. Tell you a bit about royalties in a moment. At the moment, China produces about 40,000 tonnes of vanadium metal a year. Russia, about 12,000 tonnes. South Africa, about 5,000 tonnes. In Brazil, about 3,000 tonnes, or about 60,000 tonnes a year are used around the world. And this is January 2025 US Geological Survey data.
Is it China and Russia, is it from an offshore resource or is that from onshore?
No, it's from reprocessing mostly slags out of our steel production. So if we produce this, we're going to produce, we know we can get 70%, 77% of the vanadium out. We've done all the work. Robertson Research here in New Zealand have helped us enormously with this. We can get 10,000 tonnes of vanadium out of this each year. That puts us up, New Zealand, at the forefront of the Western world's largest producer of vanadium and the world's third largest producer with a material amount. So this is truly significant for New Zealand and, quote, TDR. This is major. How are we going to do that? We've got to spend a lot of money to do that. We're going to invest $1 billion. Kiwi, or 600 million US. You can see here where we're going to spend that money. There's a pie chart here, too fine for you to read from your desk there, but we've got a vessel, hull, equipment and integration. That's basically an empty vessel. Some people might say that's about what I've got above my shoulders, but let's hope not. The process and a processing plant that we put on top of it is $163 million of that. That's a very expensive piece of kit that we load on top of this vessel to process the minerals. And a dewatering is equipment we put on the transfer vessel to dewater it, because we flush this material with fresh water from the reverse osmosis plant, and it gets dewatered, and that water goes back into the ocean where we sucked it from, and it's slightly saline when it goes back in, but we're putting highly saline back beside it where we're using the reverse osmosis plant. So that's a balance, net balance of zero. And then the crawlers, two of them about 100 million. And then we've got 80 megawatt power station, 66 million. The desalination plant, 22 million. This is planning and engineering and management. And then we've got an anchor handling vessel, about 5.5 million. These are US figures. The environmental monitoring vessel will be about a $5 million vessel sitting out there doing this work. We build it, we'll put it out there. And the geological survey vessel is about a $10 million vessel, because we've got all the drilling equipment and things on that as well. These are very specialised bits of equipment. And we've got a risk in here of about, I think it's about 14% or something, but that's, at the moment, it's a pre-feasibility study. That's normal to have that risk in there. We don't know. We've got to get our approvals and then bank this. In other words, do a bankable feasibility study and firm up on these figures. But that is 2025, that 2025 figures.
Is that information broken down and detailed in the application?
Yes, process? In a look at the PFS study?
Yes,
it's all there.
And does that tell us where that expenditure occurs, whether it's in New Zealand or overseas?
Yes, and there's a breakdown of that. I think only about 10% of that CapEx is in New Zealand.
Right.
And that is in the documents. Right. Absolutely.
Alan, just checking the geological vessel. Is that the one you already own?
No, we don't own one. That belongs to New Zealand Diving and Salvage, who've done all the work with us, and we work with them, and they are the people that we'll engage to take you out if you're going to go out there. Yeah. So, and operating costs. So there's two things here. There's CapEx, which is an investment, mostly overseas, true. I think about 10% of it in New Zealand breakdowns here. OpEx, where we're going to spend $250 million a year in the local community. Well, I'll tell you where we're going to spend it. This here, the crawler's going to cost us about $1.29 a tonne, US figures again, dollars. The integrated mining vessel, about $15 a tonne. Floating storage and offloading vessel, basically a higher situation. These vessels exist, we just hire one. We can bring it in tomorrow morning. And about $7 a tonne, and our anchor handling vessel, $1.85 a tonne to operate. And an environmental monitoring vessel, $1 a tonne. So that's $5 million US we'll be spending on operating costs to do the environmental monitoring, which is about 10 million Kiwi, quite a lot. Now, who are we spending this money on? Leasing, that's the transfer vessel. Our fuel's a big one, a very low sulfur fuel we use, the lowest emissions possible. Bunkering at 7,000 tonnes of fuel oil a month, quite a lot, but that's it. That's all we do. Repairs and maintenance, labour, that's people, staff, insurance. We have, I've got to get my number right.
500 million.
500 million public liability insurance. It has to be kept alive for the 30 odd years to ensure that if there are any adverse effects, New Zealand, the EPA can claim on that policy and fix it up, if that's the case, if that happens. So miscellaneous costs and environmental monitoring and training. We'll have a large training process underway. We're establishing a logistics hub and a training institute in Hawea as well. We'll have choppers going from New Plymouth to Hawea out to site. We will train people in the local community. It's in our conditions, proposed conditions, that we will give them preference for jobs and training. So that's where the operating costs, and we'll spend $250 million a year in the local district operating this, whether we make a dollar or not. Of course, if we're not making too many dollars, we'll stop. That's true. But that's what it just costs us, the base load, and keep going. And so, summary. CapEx, about $1 billion Kiwi, or 600 million. Operating costs, about $27 a tonne. But we're going to get about $78 worth of iron. That's $90 with a 13% discount, because you get a discount on 57% FE compared to 62% FE, which is the standard, global standard. There's a lot of iron ores out of Australia that are much less than this going, but a lot of them around 55, particularly FMG. It's quite normal. There's a sale for these products, and we're exporting it out of Tararua at the moment. Waikato North End's mining it and put it in into Glenbrook, and I can tell you more about that if you want, but it's being mined and sold, as well as, of course, for over 50 years now, from Waipipi, it was exported, that's all been closed now on the Taranaki coast where we are, and rehabilitated. It's now a housing estate. So that's what happens to old mines. And we get $23 worth of vanadium. Gives us a concentrate of about $100 US a tonne. For the economists amongst you, that's currently at all discounted at a 10% NPV, which is a discount rate of 10% interest. As we know, interest rates are a lot lower than that at the moment, but and I can do a we've got a sensitivity analysis, and I can take you through the various prices of iron ore and or discount rates, and you see how it affects it. But this is just the middle of the road, and 10% discount rate is normal for a PFS. When we get to bankable, we'll probably bring that, we'll tighten that up and bring it down to perhaps 5 or 6% NPV discount. But you can see it's not a bad profit here. If it's costing us that, after payback of this takes 18 months, we get that, there's quite a difference. It's a very, very profitable project. It will return those profit to investors. As I said, 30% of those are Kiwi. We would welcome this company to be 100% Kiwi. It's not going to happen. It will not happen. And I'll tell you why. Not because I'm a Kiwi, a very proud Kiwi. Because all major mining projects around $1 billion plus require foreign investment. That is the case in Australia as well. There's not a single project in Australia of $1 billion or more that doesn't get foreign investment in it. And if you think about it, BHP and Rio anyway are foreign companies, because they're largely funded out of Hong Kong and London and the US. That's where they fund it from. But foreign, then they require foreign investment. Woodside, out of Perth, where I live, is currently developing another gas field off the Northwest Shelf. It's $1 billion, and that's on foreign investment. They themselves, so the world's one of the world's largest oil companies, are seeking foreign investment for that project. There are no New Zealand mining companies. All New Zealand mining companies are substantive mining companies. This is a substantive application. Are all Australian or Canadian listed. There are no New Zealand mining companies. I got one going back in the 80s, and had to shift it to Australia to get the depth of equity and capital markets to build that company into, it was then a $1.5 to $2 billion company. But you have to get foreign investment, and it's good for the nation. But remember, we'll be offsetting that with $850 million of foreign exchange credits each year here, minimum. But look at the sleeper down the bottom. And Robertson Research are working very hard, and we think we can also get credit for the titanium. This is a certainty, we know about this. And as I say, Tahoe are exporting them at the moment, and there's Tennant Metals out of South Africa exporting VTM product into China at the moment. And they are getting the credits. In fact, they're getting a much more than this a ton because of the vanadium. If we can finalise how we get this last bit of titanium out of the residues when we process this, these figures will go through the roof. But so will the royalties to the New Zealand government, because they say, well, we don't know. If I go and do all that offshore, we won't get the credit for the titanium or the vanadium, and we won't know. Here's how the royalties work. Very simple. We have to pay to the government of New Zealand 2% royalties on revenue. If we sell anything, automatically, even if we're not making a profit, 2% of revenue, not a profit, goes to the New Zealand government. As soon as we make a profit, 10% of profits go to the government, and we have to pay whichever is greater, 2% revenue or 10% of profits. So if we're getting paid for the vanadium and titanium offshore, it'll go to our bottom line, it'll be a profit, and we pay royalty. So the New Zealand government will get credit for it. The New Zealand community will get credit for it.
Can you just explain a bit more? You've indicated you know how much titanium resource there is.
Yes.
Why is it you don't know if you can extract it?
We do know that we can extract it. In fact, we're getting up to 70-odd%, 77% recoveries in our metallurgical report, which you have in there. The problem with it is at the moment, I have a code of ethics that I'm bound by, and I report to the Australian Stock Exchange, and until we can demonstrate that it's marketable and we can have an offtake agreement for it, I am not allowed to put it in my figures.
Does your evidence explain that opportunity in more detail?
Yes. And it's in the PFS study again. Go to the metallurgical report by SciCap. I think they wrote that in March 2025, and it's there.
Yep. So you believe it will be marketable?
Yes.
Yep.
We certainly do. But we're not making wild claims about it till we can prove that. And as I say, it's part of what I'm bound by in reporting to the Australian Stock Exchange.
So how does one prove that?
We have, effectively. It's not now a matter of proof. As I said, it's a matter of getting offtake agreements for it. So we've got to go now and get offtake agreements to take that. As soon as we've tabled one of those on there, we're allowed to put that in our forward-looking statements and put it into the resource statement. We do think we can refine that a bit. There's a little bit more metallurgical process flow. If you're interested, I'll tell you very quickly how that's done. We get the titanium magnetite, the black sand. We salt roast it, and that roasting reduces the volume of the sand by around about 30%. But we wind up with pig iron and vanadium residue with the titanium going to a slag. The pig iron, we've got 2/3 of the volume we had for iron ore, but pig iron is a direct feed to a blast furnace and is worth 4 times as much as iron ore. So we do that process. We've got a very valuable leftover in pig iron. So we lose volume, but we've got 3 to 4 times the value in US dollars.
So
So that's, and then we get the vanadium. We can get the vanadium straight out there, and that's a SXEW leach, which is a technical term for solvent extraction, but we can get that out. And we're left with the titanium in a slag. Now what we need is a market for that. And there's a lot of work been done on that from Glenbrook Steel as well here in New Zealand, trying to sell their vanadium and titanium credits out of this slag from Glenbrook.
So that salt roast process, is that something that could be done on the ship, or is that
No, we couldn't, ship's not big enough for that. And we've also been asked, well, would you bring that on shore to New Zealand? And the short answer to that is no. I'll tell you why. If we, TDR's a small company, and New Zealand has very high environmental standards, which we applaud, but there's a lot of work to go through to get something done here. If we bring 5 million tonnes of iron ore into Port Wellington, Port of Wellington, good luck, we're not going to be very popular. We're going to need a big rail system to shift it, or we're going to have to take it to another port somewhere. We couldn't get it into Taranaki, but it's too small. Nelson's a vague possibility. But maybe Lyttelton. But then we're going to need rail infrastructure, land, holding sites for large volumes of material, 5 million tonnes a year is a lot of stuff. Then we're going to have to go and find a piece of land and go through an approval process like we're going through right now to process that and deal with the emissions, deal with the water contamination problems, deal with the alkalines and the acids and the disposal of those. I have got grey hair, white hair, actually, and I can tell you, I haven't got time in my life to go through another 30 years of trying to get a project like that up here. If we can, and if New Zealand can do it, and you've got some great scientists here, if we can get this in the future, let's do it. But it's not as simple as doing the science and getting on with it. This approval process is a major part of any operation you're thinking about that might be commercial and turn a dollar and employ people anywhere in the world, but particularly here in New Zealand. So you've got to keep that in mind when you think about these things. Whereas there are plants operating in the US, the EU, and in Korea and Japan that can do this right now and are operating with all the approvals in place, obviously, they're ticking away. So we can get it done, but not here. And just imagine road freight with 5 million tonne a year cruising up the transmission gully. So I'm getting now just about to the end, you'll be pleased to know. Regional and local benefits. 20-year mine life. We've got a 60-year resource out there. I won't harp on about that. But we've got 3 billion tonnes. In 20 years, we'll extract 1 billion tonnes or 50 million tonnes a year over 20 years. It's not fly in, fly out. We'll have a head office in New Plymouth and a hardware training and logistics base, which I mentioned. We'll directly employ 300. The vessel takes up about 270 operational staff, and that's because we've got about 125 out there at any one time. We'll be turning them over 2 weeks by 2 weeks, but not a whole lot every 2 weeks. Every day, 10 to a dozen to 15 will be transferred, and it's a slow migration through the team as the operation goes along. We're going to have about 30-odd people on the geological survey vessel, the marine monitoring vessels, the anchor handling tug, and things as well to support. So they'll be going on. And we'll have about 35 in marketing, head office, health and safety, HR, and on we go in New Plymouth. It is a challenge to get the skilled professionals we need to come to places like New Plymouth, and that's a worldwide problem. Many of the people that we need are much younger than me, but they're in their mid-40s to 50s. They've often got children heading into universities and things, and they want to be living in places where I live most of the time, in Perth. And there's good reason for that. It's the mining capital of the world, the good universities, good services, and they say, and Marge, the wife, says, George, you can go off over there, you can do that. But I'm not going. We're staying here and getting the kids through university. So it's a bit of a challenge to get the right professionals. But with COVID and some of the things that have gone on recently in geopolitics and the unsettling things in Europe and the US, perhaps, and Asia. There's a lot of professionals that are now becoming quite keen to come back here. There's a huge number of Kiwis in Perth. I don't want to harp on about it, but Perth is New Zealand's third largest city, and it's actually full of people in the mining industry like myself. There's a lot of them over there, and a lot of them are keen to come back. So we want to get them back, but we also want to train locals. We want this to be local. We're here for 20 years, and I'd like to think in the future for many more. Responsibly mining, responsibly looking after the environment, and getting those skills and that knowledge back to the entire community, as well as doing the environmental monitoring.
Alan, just before you go off the staff issue, I noticed the social impact assessment was referring, it's a bit older, and it was referring to a head office in Wellington.
It was, yes, that's true. That was the original plans back in 16, 17, was to have it out of Wellington. And that was later for the reasons I've just explained. It's hard enough to get people into the regions here, never mind. Yeah, but I think people like Waihee and Macraes have shown that you can get good skilled staff back into these regional areas. And we would like to perhaps replicate that and see if we can do that. So that's a change in plan.
Okay. And just clarifying, how did the staff on these, you've said it's a 2-week roster, how do they get back and forth from the ships?
Helicopter.
Helicopter.
Yep. It's the same as, the transfer is the same as what the oil and gas industry are doing at the moment to the offshore oil platforms in Taranaki and have done for 30-odd, 40 years.
So you outsource that service?
Sorry.
Will you be hiring, you know, paying some other service provider to do that?
Oh, absolutely. Transfer? We're not going to become helicopter operators ourselves. We might put a sign on the side of it, but we'll get international helicopter groups who are doing oil and gas up there to. We'll engage with them, and everybody's got to go through health and safety and survival courses, even to go on those choppers. There's an institute there, Woods Training in New Plymouth, that do that already. We're working with them, we're talking with them, we'll have an agreement with them to do all that. Yeah. We'll stick to our netting.
Thank you.
Okay, there's a charitable trust or two to be put in place. And they are actually managed by the regional council and the locals.
Before you go off that, you haven't touched on the improvements that you're proposing in Taranaki and Whanganui and the ports.
Sorry. We have spoken to Port Taranaki and Port Whanganui. And Port Taranaki will need a hard stand area, quite a large hard stand area, because all of our plant's modular, and if anything goes wrong with any part of it, we can actually extract like part of the reverse osmosis plant or the power system. I mean, it's 18 megawatt units. We can lift one off with our equipment, put it on our anchor handling vessel, bring it in, get it serviced, and take another one out and pop on. And heavy engineering, if anything goes wrong, it's all modular, we'll bring the equipment into Port Taranaki, get it fixed and take it out, but we're able to carry on in the meantime. So that is, and we're actively talking to them. They've got an area there that is suitable for that. And Whanganui Port, we want to run the environmental monitoring vessel and a grade control, geological grade control vessels, both very important, out of Port Whanganui. It's a shorter trip for them. We can get in and out daily as we operate, or they may stay out overnight at times, but when the weather's right. But that is the closest port, rather than it's 170 k's from our mine site round Mount Egmont to Port Taranaki, and it's exactly 170 k's to Port Nelson. So that's where we are, but Whanganui is about 40 or 50 k's. So.
Okay. Thank you.
So for the nation, there's 1,300 jobs. Will be, and this is all from the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research independent analysis. We'll pay $55 million in royalties. Some of that may go to royalties for regions if various political parties get their way, but I'm not here to promote that. And $136 million a year in corporate taxes. That's nearly $200 million a year discounted at the moment. We think it'll be higher. $200 million a year. We're not going to put a pothole in the road. We're not coming anywhere near demanding water or services of any sort or power. This is how it works out and how those royalties will be paid. The more profitable we'll be, the higher that will go in terms of corporate taxes and royalties. $495 million at the moment in foreign exchange earning. The New Zealand dollar's currently collapsing, so that would be over $900 million per annum right now on this same figure. And as I say, $1 billion investment. It is meaningful in terms of the industry statistics here. We're exporting about $1.46 or $1.5 billion of metals and mineral products a year. They want to double that by 2035. We'll add $900 million to that. So think about that. We're going to achieve what the people in Wellington want virtually overnight. It's been a struggle. It's been very tough. The approvals process, over 12 years and $88 million over. We've been through the EPA DMC hearing process three times. I'm not going to labour on about these things. This is a new application under new law. We'll keep going. We've had court challenges, including the Supreme Court, which focused on legal definitions and purpose of the EEZ Act legislation, the DMC panel grants process and their write-up and how they justified their decision, certainty of information principles, which I'll rapidly get out of my depth on here, but that's what we're being challenged, and tikanga and treaty issues were not even on the radar when we applied, but by the time we got to the Supreme Court in 2021, they were, and treaty and the application of tikanga principles, which Paul will tell you more about shortly. So they're not about the project, the environmental impact, protection or conditions. They were about the law. Now, we've had a large number of challenges as well, which again, I won't bore you with, but there was a dolphin reserve put in place all along that coast, which allows harbour dredging, seismic surveys for oil and gas and oil and gas production, and some fishing, but does not allow any mineral exploration or mining activity. We put a very good case when Eugenie Sage put that up as a proposal and put the evidence and science before them that we would have no effect on Maui dolphins. And I've hopefully demonstrated that to you, and it's in the application, the backup data for that. And that didn't happen. That went in. And the only reason that we've still got our project is they would have to compensate us by taking a tenement off us within that 12 nautical mile limit. It's a statutory right. They couldn't do that without compensation, so they chose to leave us there, hoping we would go away. So I believe that reserve is more about banning seabed mining than it is about saving dolphins. Okay. We then had 2023, we had an inquiry into seabed mining, a government inquiry into seabed mining. They decided that we better have a look at you guys and see what you're really up to. So I presented at that. I presented them digital and hard copy, 12,000 pages of information on seabed mining and what we're doing off that coast. The response from the chair of that inquiry was, "Mr. Eggers, we do not want that information." Her next sentence was, "The problem we have here is that there's insufficient information about seabed mining for us to be able to assess what's going on. Here's the information. We'll present it. We'll give it to you. We'll go through it." No. That information was given back to us and rejected. We gave it to them in digital form and hard copy. 21 volumes of hard copy. They didn't want it. Te Pāti Māori put a bill in to ban seabed mining into Parliament. Luckily, that didn't get anywhere, as far as we're concerned. I've got to be honest. Luckily, it didn't get anywhere, but that was simply a bill to ban seabed mining. They've had a go at us from every angle. They then went, this year, they went to the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal and said, "Come on, stand up and ban seabed mining." And I think the response to that was, no, we won't do that, but we'll wait and see what the outcome is, and hopefully it's a fair hearing. And that's my understanding of what the treaty said only a month or two ago. Our opponents have bought shares in the company. They've attended meetings. They've disrupted our meetings illegally. They've locked up New Zealand Minerals Council in their office, all publicity stunts to raise money. And they've reported this recently to the ASIC, if you like, the policeman, for me and our listed companies, the corporate regulators in Australia and the ASX, with complaints. And that got headlines here in New Zealand in the paper. We've never received a complaint from the ASIC or the ASX. Anybody can complain to them. That doesn't mean it's a valid complaint, and we've never heard from them, and we're fine. And they say it was over my disclosure of our resources and our project, and we were misleading the public. Well, I stand here and say good luck with that. I'm very straightforward. We're very transparent in what we've been doing, and the information's there for anybody to see, including right now, anybody can go to your very own Fast Track site and access any piece of information they want. And it's on our website as well. And now, the Energy Minister, the Honourable Simon Watts, is seeking advice to restrict seabed mining and the space allocation offshore. I've made a submission to senior MIMBY officials on that, just on the perspective of where we're at, and hopefully I've explained some of that to you people here today, why we can coexist out there, but not right on top of each other. Righto, I reckon I'm just about there. So during the approvals process over 10 years, the Supreme Court took the unusual action of inviting the Attorney General's Office, Crown Law, and the EPA to make submissions to the court. That's very unusual. As I'm sure the Chair will acknowledge. And the Attorney-General was granted leave by the Supreme Court to intervene on legal issues in an upcoming appeal between the Project Manager, TDR, and Iwi Fishing, Environment and Conservation Groups opposed to the project. South Taranaki, Iwi, Ngāi Ruanui say a submission by the Attorney-General's Office to the Supreme Court had bolstered the project and was an attempt to prop up the mining industry. And Ngāi Ruanui suggested that the Attorney General's intervention risks an environmental disaster. Hopefully, myself and our experts have explained that we don't think there's any environmental disaster out here to be found. And their submissions covered the Treaty of Waitangi, Maori customary interests, and application of tikanga marine discharge consents under the EEZ Act. This is in the Supreme Court. This is Crown Law. We agreed with them, and we believe that those submissions supported our position. They're there for anybody to read. They're in our information, and I think those decisions are all sitting in the application. And if not, they're certainly publicly available. So that's about me. It's an opportunity to develop a $1 billion export industry that propels New Zealand into the top-ranked producer of critical and essential minerals and green steel feed. I've told you about that, the low-carbon steel. And in fact, this material with hydrogen in the future can actually make steel and avoid the use of coal. It's another story. Proven technology solution with experienced operators. 300-odd years from Royal IHC, and 35 years going on, 40 years of seabed mining, De Beers Marine will build to spec, commission, operate and train people to operate this technology offshore. That's the agreement we have with them. We've got a world-class resource with low operating costs. You've got to have low operating costs, you've got to get knocked out of business by the rest of the world. We've got that. We've got a small footprint and we believe it's environmentally sustainable, and it's for us to convince this panel and the community, importantly the community, that is the case. And we won't resolve from that. We'll go out there, we'll give them the information, we're transparent, and we'll deliver. So it's going to be one of New Zealand's largest export earners, a major employer of high-value jobs. The average salary in New Zealand in the mining industry is $101,000 a year. The average salary in New Zealand is $66,000 a year at the moment. Current stats. They're high value jobs. We pay well, we want people to work well, and we want to look after their well-being, but it's not a low-tech industry with pick and shovels. We use really high-tech gear, IT people, economists, geologists, engineers, ecologists, marine researchers. That's who we're using, and that's who's employed, engaged in this industry. So we'd like that green light. Make no apologies. We're here to get through an approvals process. We're not here to educate or particularly listen to me. We think we've provided the information, a very comprehensive application. It is not yesterday's application, it's current. And we think we've got a good set of operating conditions and management plans proposed. And we believe that seabed mining and recovery is part of the solution. Because my final statement is, we live in the metals age and the technology age. We do not live in the stone age. If you want to go back to that, that's fine, but I'm not going there, and I'm not taking my children and my grandchildren there. We have the highest standard of living because of metals. And the thing is that everything we use, everything you do, is dependent on metals and technology. And New Zealand should be part of that, not exporting pollution somewhere else, if that's what's happening. We should be part of that and proud of what we do. There's nothing that you do, from your glass of water, to flushing your toilet, to your fridge, to getting your food. Your food is no longer gathered in the fields with a stick. Your food is produced by GPSs, satellites, and John Deere tractors. It is transported by high-tech trucks, refrigeration, supermarkets, packaging, whether you like it or not, to preserve that food. It's actually, a lot of it's irradiated, using nuclear science to make it last longer and preserve it. We live in a technology age. The highest conservation in the world is not where you don't have mining. The thing is that I've worked in Asia, Africa, and South America, where you don't have mining and you don't have a high standard of living. Have a look at your conservation, have a look at your rivers, have a look at your coastline, have a look at your oceans, and have a look at your national parks. They're polluted because people need to be in there doing things. New Zealand has magnificent state parks and national parks. They're fabulous because we can afford them, and we can afford to look after our waste. And we can afford to have a high standard of living based on metals. I'm not going back, and I don't believe that my grandchildren should either. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Regas. I greatly appreciate that help. So we'll take a break for lunch.
Yeah, after lunch we'll have Paul, who patiently sat through my monologue.
So 12... So 10 past one. So resume again. Thank you very much.
Okay. So what was that amount?
Ten past.
Half an hour?
Yeah.
Okay.